For instance, there was recently an elementary school planned in Anchorage, which had an amount of money programmed for site preparation. When the district got into that site and found some real problems associated with construction.
Is that the Golden View site that you're referring to, or the Flat Road site?
I can't recall the exact name. Anyway, the site problems drove up the costs. Materials that are required by the architect can often drive up costs. So it just depends on what you're building, where you're building it, and out of what material you're planning to construct it. In terms of the geographic differences between construction costs, it's cheaper to build in Mesa. They're close to a transportation hub. They have readily available a variety of contractors, sources of equipment. The contingencies that a construction project is apt to encounter in that kind of area are minimized simply by virtue of the proximity to the people and things that can remedy them. In terms of the difference between the $170, I believe it was, for Dot Lake and the
Clock One,
and the higher amount for Skagway, I'd have to take a look at what kinds of considerations that are included in those respective plans or project estimates. I'm not competent to begin with to give you, as I said, an authoritative description or rundown on construction costs, but if I were, I would still have to look at the kinds of elements in the plans, and I can't do it without that.
Senator Mulcahy?
Mr. Chairman, I might just add something, and I can't address the direct questions either, but in my district, we've gone to multi-purpose rooms, if you will, and for the number of square feet that they're pretty expensive, but they address a number of purposes. They're half gyms, and they're opened up, and everything is folded back in the wall. But then you can take that half gym and bring out folded doors and close them off, say, into two general classroom areas. You then can take the bleachers out of the wall and form the kind of the open concept schoolroom, for the bleachers that have the desks on them, create within one of those areas four different classrooms, so you can have four different classrooms going along with it. Also within each one of those communities, those facilities are used by the community, and I imagine this is what Dot Lake is doing with theirs. Is they aren't facilities like in most communities that are just used during the day, that they're used well into the evenings and over the weekends. I'd like to give probably a typical example of some of the remote sites that I had within my own district late last session. We lost a school at Chignik Lake, and Chignik Lake is on the peninsula, and we had to address it late in the session. We worked very closely with the department for square footage figures, so there wouldn't be a Taj Mahal built, but just the transportation. The materials were freighted from outside to Kodiak by standard freight that comes up to Kodiak and Anchorage and Seward and Homer and Cordova, basically sealand transportation. At Kodiak, they had to charter a landing barge. And this landing barge then moved that material from Kodiak over to Chignik Lagoon. At Chignik Lagoon, that material had to be transferred onto a barge that took it up to Chignik River. At Chignik River, that material from the school had to be transferred to Skiff and Kickers to take it up Chignik River up to Chignik Lake. That appropriation was made late last session. That school will be opening up this spring. But you can imagine all the handling, the transportation costs that went in, and it's just basically a stick structure school that went on to it. But that transportation handling is all going to go into every square foot. And if you built the same type of a facility in, say, Kodiak, you would have just had that sea land leg of that. You wouldn't have had that $2,300 a day charter with a landing craft to move it another 400 miles or 300 miles. You wouldn't have had the barge that they had to make arrangements for and lease to move it from the, across the lake and up into the river. And then they had to go out and hire the people from the village with their individual skiffs to run it up the river to the site. And you can only move it at high tides when the tide backs up the river enough to get enough depth for a kicker. So, and that all goes into the square footage of that school. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
State.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fakes, imagine if you can for a moment what it would cost to build that $170 square foot school in the Matsu Valley on Diomede Island, where the material has to be shipped. If we're fortunate on the North Star, if we're not fortunate, by Sikorsky Sky Crane at $2,300 an hour, and the site preparation involved is mind-boggling. It truly is. The only available space is on the side of a mountain. Those are the kinds of things that drive up the costs, and those costs are generally estimated by architects based on the material requirements and the designs. In terms of the multipurpose room that you mentioned, the department is not in the business of advocating for community centers. In the alternative, if a district or a community needs multipurpose space, it only makes sense to design that space so that it can accommodate the widest variety of interests, both academic and community. If the state's going to invest $1 million or $2 million, it only makes sense to make sure that that space lends itself to the broadest variety of interests and activities. And that's entirely consistent with the whole community schools concept. So to that extent, I think it makes sense.
Steve, would you give us a brief, our time is running out, we have to get downstairs, but a brief rundown on the payback that the state has given to the boroughs and first-class cities up until 1977 or whenever the year was and what it is now?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For cash payments or payments made upon bonds, notes, or other indebtedness associated with municipal school construction, for those costs incurred before 1977, the state reimburses by statute 100% of those payments. As a practical matter, the actual reimbursement runs between 75 and 100%. If there's lots of revenue, we can fully fund or the legislature has fully funded the account and we've been able to reimburse 100%. For projects after 1977, the state reimburses by statute at 90%. This year, I believe that amount was at about 82% because of the shortfall in the appropriation. For projects for which debt is incurred after December 31 of 1981, the state reimburses 90%, but in the same year the payment is made. For pre-1981 indebtedness, there is a two-year lag. That is, local taxpayers or municipalities have to bear the costs associated with those bonds for 2 years before the state begins reimbursing. Under Chapter 92 of last year, the post-December 31 of 1981 projects are reimbursed in the same year. So, depending upon the availability of revenue, there is much less a local burden borne for those projects.
Yes, Chair, I'm glad you brought that up because that was really part of what I had in mind in the first broad question. What does this cover, this reimbursement? Does that include roof repair and right to construction of a new high school, or what?
Basically, anything associated with construction, repair, or renovation that's of a project size in excess of $25,000. There are some exclusions set out in 4318-100, which exclude from eligibility certain kinds of swimming pools and certain types of single-purpose space, but basically anything the department has approved under its school construction regulations, the costs of which are borne by the local municipality.
When do the state, when do the legislature start funding by direct appropriation schools within school districts, not, in other words, non-REA schools?
My experience is limited to about the last 5 or 6 years, but in, to the best of my knowledge, there have been small projects just about every year, at least during that time frame, and certainly during the HB 60 time frame.
HB 60 was 1980.
Yes, sir. From time to time, particularly smaller municipalities with a very depressed tax base have had no alternative but to seek a special appropriation.
But in terms of widespread state appropriation for school construction within incorporated districts, that started essentially in 1980.
Yes, sir. And as a matter of state policy, this is the first year.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have to adjourn the meeting now to get downstairs for the meeting. I know that Lee Stoops with Senator Sack's office had some important information to give to us. We'll have that tomorrow. That's all. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, from my point of view, I really appreciate having a member of the Department of Education come and testify. It's been very helpful.
Yes.
Chairman, likewise, this has been very valuable in terms of providing a background, and as you indicated, we still want to go through the various budgets, but this was very, very valuable in terms of understanding what's going on.
We'll adjourn the meeting the business to come before the
and, interesting, when I got a first class city at Sand Point, and I know you're
first item we'll take up this morning is regarding the questions that came up at the previous hearing on square footage costs. And the university has Chris Avoy down here and Fred King. If you can come and join us at the head of the table, we'll...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just reiterate what I've said before these people. To get the camera out and to get them in there. Move the camera.
The sign-up sheet shows Fred King and Chris Ahoy.
Okay.
And for the record, will you identify yourself, please? We'll...
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is Chris Ahoy. I'm the Director of Facilities for Planning and Construction at the University of Alaska. And my left is Fred King, the University Architect.
Okay. Just so that you know where we are, my concern was about the cost of construction with regard to educational facilities, not only the University of Alaska, but also the IAAs and school districts. And traditionally, what we've done in the legislature is always to take at face value the cost there, and then afterwards see the structures kind of built. And in the past, we've had huge palace-type structures that, in my opinion, with the decline in revenues, we've got to take a second look at, not only for the University of Alaska, but also for school districts and REAs out in the rural areas. In researching the different costs related to construction, there's a method that the university uses that's different than that used by the state of Alaska through DOT, the Department of Transportation. You've got your own system, you've got your own people, and your own method. And I guess what we need this morning is to find out what that is, to find out what the differences are, and to find out what the percentages for each component are that you charge for various things, and to find out why we have such high costs and this is not, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, because we have high costs everywhere, just to find out why we have these high costs and what can be done to decrease them.
Okay. I think a piece of paper was passed around to you. Budget form. It looks like this.
You have an extra copy of that?
You can have this one. If you look at that, what it does is breaks down the general bond obligation, direct appropriation monies into different categories. There are basically five categories, and what we try to do is to allocate the money into line items for each project as when it comes up. First cost are bond costs. If I can walk you through the line. Second cost is what we call reimbursement of Plan Fund 1. Those are costs that are associated with some of the design things that we get early in the stage, that is taken out of the project when we get funded. If you look at Category A, those are all the design costs that are involved in developing plans and documentation for a project before it goes out to bid. Item B is the place, is the most important one for us, which is the construction costs. I mean, the total dollars that go into building a building. Generally, those costs are roughly from 72% to about 82.3% of the total project costs. Now, you probably wonder why, where the rest of the other percentage goes. They're basically distributed in the rest of the line items. Some of them go for equipment, some of them go for administrative charges, others go for design fees. Is there any question on that? Do you understand?
Starting at the top. Say, for example, there's a need for a classroom at the University of Alaska campus in Fairbanks. You get a request for a certain number of classrooms that you want. Who makes the decision as to what type of building is going to house those classrooms? I went to the University of Alaska for 9 years. I started in the Duckering building, which is a classroom building. I also attended classes in the Greening building, which is a classroom building. Those two buildings are about 2 to 3 or 4 times different in terms of cost, even if you built them at the same time, because the materials used are different, the design is different, all of these different types of things. They're different, but yet both of them are classrooms. Who makes a decision as to what type of classroom is going to be built?
Good question. Most of those decisions on the programmatic areas as academic programs is determined by the kind of things that you want to teach in that facility. For instance, if you compare fine arts learning with scientific kind of teaching, they're two entirely different kind of programs. In a more arts-oriented program, they're more basic general assignment type of classrooms. But in a more physics, chemistry-oriented program, you have a lot of lab facilities, which differs again in other areas like community colleges and work tech, different kinds of programs determine the different shapes of building.
Who makes that decision?
The campus.
The campus.
Mm-hmm. Academic campus group.
Okay. I give up.
Mr. Hoy, I think the question goes, if I can follow Senator Sackett, mm-hmm. Goes beyond the matter of academic decision making. It goes to the question of materials and aesthetics and the life expectancy of the building. Those are the kinds of things I think I would want to know.
Yeah. It might be like
arbitrary. I mean, are we? Does the tail wag the dog here? Do we follow as appropriators a decision made by someone with his or her own concept of what a classroom facility ought to be, or is there some objective criteria used as to how much per square foot the public should pay.
Yeah. Might be good if you could bear with me a little and walk you through the process of how the development of a project is done. There are several stages of doing a project. It starts off with academic program. When the academic program is approved, there are two kinds of program that exist. One is the mission and statements and the documents the academic people want to as to exactly what they want to teach. Based upon that, develops what we call an architectural program, which is a different kind of thing, which is the one that quantifies the square footage in terms of the needs of the types of classrooms, the size of classrooms, the complexity of classrooms, the lab spaces and all that. All this decision-making process is a continuous process between the user committee, which is consisting of faculty members, the campus academic vice presidents, and us. It's like a negotiating session as to what is it that ultimately drives the academic program to develop into a space. So when all that is ironed out, then we hire what we call a consultant to design the facilities based upon those documents that we produce. It's like an understanding, and it's like an agreement between the user committee as to what the building should consist of. To answer Senator Sack's question, so obviously, doctoring, deferring from somebody else, there were probably two different entities that developed the programs.
Well, let me interrupt just a second. That's not quite true, because Dufferin was one building that was Fastroads. But now, if I'm correct in the name of the building, which was next to it, upstairs had labs and stuff like that, and that's where I took my chemistry and physics courses. And that, in terms of the structure and the quality, is not consistent with the latest ones that have a lot more added into them, which I question whether or not really assist in the final product, which is the teaching of that particular course. The reason that I'm asking these questions is that we're to the point now where we're getting classroom requests from universities, the university and other systems, one classroom building for $25 million. And it's something that I think that the legislature has to look in terms of the entire state, because we have a request also for a court building for $43 million. And somebody, someplace, is making a decision as to the quality and the level of type of building that is going to be built. And all we end up here with is the final figure. And at some point in time, we need to get involved in saying, hey, you don't need that quality, and you can still function at a much less quality or less costly building.
You sample well that rectangle, the land is available, and so on.
We make some of the decisions along with the campus user committee in terms of the quality of building and what it goes, the material that you were talking about, Senator Josephson. The capital cost of building varies with the complexity of the building and what you want to put in. There are a lot of code things that come up from year to year that changes. If you remember, every 3 years there's a federal code that keeps on increasing in terms of its complexity and the demands that it requires on how a building should be built. Most of our facilities are highly, intensively used facilities. For life protection situation, there are lots of codes come up over the years that are becoming more and more restrictive. That adds the cost to that. So if you look at a building that was 15 years ago, and you build a building today, they're not the same ingredients.
No, of course.
So the cost differential from those that were built 15 years to the ones today, some of them can be impacted by codes and dictated by those issues.
In order to look at this, I'm going to need more time, and obviously you will too. We have to make comparisons between your building methods and those which are part of transportation, and we also have to make comparisons with private industry, because they do have the same codes that they have. And we all know that the costs of a privately built building are much less than one built by the state of Alaska. I don't know that we can do that today, but it's something we do have to look into. But the reason that we did bring it up today is the fact that we have these requests before us for classrooms that I consider to be exceedingly high.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, hi, how are you today?
Hi, thank you.
The Anchorage classroom is $269 a square foot. The Fairbanks classroom is $355.87 a square foot. What's the difference between the two buildings?
I'm glad you asked the question because it seems to be a question that the Board of Regents asks all the time, too. And there are a lot of factors that are involved. In fact, what we did was to ferret out this question last year, we had a task force work session with the Board of Regents and a lot of the pretty well-known contractors from all around the state, plus the architects and the engineers who developed the buildings. And we found out after that session that university buildings do not necessarily cost more than privately built buildings. What we found out in that session was, it's the way we look at the cost. If you strictly look at a building, just its shell itself, let's take an office building downtown or something. Most office buildings downtown are developed on a shell basis. So if you just look at the cost for the shell, there's one kind of cost. If you have a piece of property and a land that needs to be developed, and you have to have utilities, parking, you have to bring energy and all that, that adds all this cost. So total project cost is different from the actual unit cost of the building. We found out that like buildings, office to office, if there was any like situation, that they actually cost the same, roughly from that I was told, at least during the discussion, it was anywhere from $80 to $120 a square foot. That's for the shell facility. If you realize that most private situations in office, it's not completely equipped. Walls are not put in, carpet's not finished, telephones are not in. University buildings are completely finished, equipped by the time they're ready. So those costs are different. We found out there's roughly about $50 to $60 a square foot to remodel the interior to bring that up. So if you add that cost to shell building cost, it almost equates the same. The other thing that happens is most of our buildings done in the past have been built on what we call buildable land. If you look in Alaska, there are very few property areas that are free of permafrost in some areas, and most university buildings are built in areas that are less of a problem. As we build more buildings later, there are more problems because there's less land available for better building sites. So those costs are impacted too. You can look at site development costs. If you look at a private situation, if you build around a very urban situation, the municipality and the various agencies, the energy package, the sewage is already brought there right up the building. Some of our campuses, we have to build all those costs before we can even do the building. So those are the other costs that add into to make the square footage costs different. So really, it depends on the kind of building or the location and the site and the area.
Continuing on, you said between $50 and $60 a square foot for the interior finish?
Yes, remodeling and equipment, yeah.
Boy, that's okay. The Sitka Community College Edition is $257 a square foot. The Matsu Community College Edition building is $160 a square foot. What's the difference there? You read their descriptions here, and the Matsu sounds like it has more laboratory space than the Sitka, and I'm just wondering why there's $100 a square foot difference in their cost.
Yeah. Well, depending on the type of building, I'm not sure exactly which building they are right now. Some of them, sometimes equipment costs are so high too. If you have a work tech situation, you may have a equipment that may cost you $250,000.
But who decides? Is there a committee, one committee that sits there on campus and looks at the needs of the various community colleges or the various campuses and decides what kind of building and how much it's going to cost?
You're asking for how the capital request comes through. Is that
but
appropriate?
Who makes that decision?
There's a several layers of decision. The user committee, the campuses, back
through. Who has the final say? Is it your campus user committee?
In terms of how the capital request ultimately comes to you, the Board of Regents, obviously.
The Board of Regents mm-hmm. makes the final decision. Who advises them?
There's a lot of hearings throughout the process in the campuses itself at the system-wide level, and decisions are made.
Who in the university is responsible for giving the prospectus to the Board of Regents on these buildings? What person is responsible?
In each campus, the chancellor is responsible for submitting his request, capital request.
Okay. Well,
Could you give us those figures again on the costs that the university has for Anchorage Fairbanks?
Sure. The Anchorage classroom building is $269 a square foot for 94,000 square feet. Fairbanks is $355.87 for 56,200 square feet. And I took total square footage, the shell, the sidewalks, the bathrooms, everything. ACC building is $225 a square foot for 47,000 square feet. Sitka is $257 a square foot for 19,500, and that's the little piece of paper you got because the university was in error on that. Matsu is $160 a square foot. I think we ought to take four of these for 23,750 square feet. And then I just tried a couple of your schools. Klok Wong is $170 a square foot. Skagway, now, for what they want, is $271 a square foot for 15,000 square feet. Dot Lake was $170 a square foot for 5,880 square feet. And that's all I did.
Senator, we noted that he concerned himself with private industry and its costs. We just built a new building in in a very expensive area in Anchorage. Why don't you check what, and very sophisticated and very architectural conforming, a beautiful building, several stories high. Got to make some of those comparisons too, perhaps, to some of the new construction of the same type building, essentially.
Yeah, I think what's happening is that in private industry, they don't have to use Class A, just bulletproof wallpaper kind of thing, unless they choose to do that. And I think what he's telling us...
Yeah, apples and oranges.
The university has to do that.
But does that make $100 a square foot difference?
It's the $50 to $60 a square foot for interior finish that just amazes me.
$200 a square foot difference in some cases.
Yeah. Mr. Hoyer, approaching this a different way. The Senate President is here from the Matsu area. Should he be concerned that on his campus the Dreamers do not dream large enough and are only coming at $160 a square foot? And if he had somebody aggressive like people down in Sitka at $257, he'd have a more ornate building. Is there some? I mean, that's I think what we're trying to get at. If this is a, I'm not asking that facetiously, I think maybe you feel I am. If this is a campus by campus decision, should there be a premium on the ambition of the at the campus level, or should there be uniformity in the approach to quality or qualitative judgment?
Well, we are, as a statewide organization, facilities planning and construction, looks after trying to unify the building construction. We do, before we request the capital programs, do cost estimating through by ourselves as well as get the assistance of expertise outside, like some contractors who have been constantly doing estimating for other contractors around the state. And some of the capital requests are developed on that basis, costing, as to what they cost in that specific area. As to what goes into each building is determined by the program that is required of each campus. As to what buildings should go in each campus, that's determined at the campus level, at the chancellor level, depending on the kind of programs that you want to generate. As to how it ultimately filters out through the whole system and comes as a total university package, it's a lot of negotiating that goes on between chancellors, statewide, amongst their own, as to seeing which requires the top priority. The Board of Regents ultimately gets the university's overall requirements. So there are a lot of things that are fallen by the wayside by the time it comes up. So the requests that you get ultimately are the ones that are the top priority of each campus.
Why don't you, we had this situation where Department of Education came forward and said that there are generally accepted standards as to space for students and criteria. Maybe the board has addressed this, but perhaps the board and the president should promulgate criteria that say for academic classrooms, the following materials are authorized and the following footage for anticipated student load is authorized and the following ceiling, height ceilings and heating systems are authorized, so that the campus has a guideline as to what is permissible and what is excessive? Or has that been done?
Yes.
On the old campuses, they would know the construction area to the foundations, masonry, the type of footing and so on.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Joseph, I'm glad you brought that question up. 24 months ago, before when I came to the University of Alaska, we've always been trying to stress to a more methodical way of asking capital requests. I'm proud to say that after 20 months, we finally produced a document that goes through all the DRUs and MEUs, standardizing them in the way they request their capital programs. It's a pretty intensive document. It talks about all the standards, spaces, the way they need to request the funding. So by the time it comes out, it's a pretty intensive process, infiltration process, that really comes out in the end, that we feel it's very responsive.
When did that take effect? When did that become...
This is the FY85 request.
Pardon?
The FY85 request.
FY85?
Mm-hmm.
So no such document is operative today, is that what you're saying?
We have in various stages, though. See, this is several iterations of this.
Apparently, the regents and the administration have the same concerns the legislature does, and they're beginning to address them, trying to.
We will be really glad to share this with you and leave some copies
yes.
for you, I think. It'll be very educational.
Mr. Chairman, just pursuing the same line and picking up where Senator Fakes left off, it seems to me that what Senator Fakes was looking for was very specifically the question: does the Board of Regents, or you as an advisor to the Board of Regents, or the president of the university, or someone, look at each of these proposals that comes to the Board of Regents from all these disparate units and say, this one looks reasonable, this one seems out of line, just the way the senators here are asking? Does anyone look at that and say, now wait a minute, this one seems way out of sight, way out of line, thou shalt reduce it to something reasonable? Is there a process like that that critically looks at the proposal from each campus?
There is a process like that. In fact, the process is almost as process that you have very critical look at different stages, which develop into a smaller version of a book like this, which develops ultimately into a larger...
Chris, yeah. The question is, who does it at what stage? I think that's what Senator Fakes was trying
to get. I see, okay.
Get.
Well, the Board of Regents meets regularly at certain points in time. We work backwards from the calendar that you people set up in terms of when you need to meet and make your decisions. October is the deadline for our final submission to the governor for a capital and operating budget. Then we work backwards. We have an operating budget and capital budget schedule where we meet several deadlines and iterations of what needs to happen at several stages to arrive at that situation. So there are lots of people involved in the decision-making process.
Chris, you're still not responding to my point. Has anyone along the way, before we got this document, has anyone looked at that and said, this figure for Anchorage is outlandish, or the square foot cost for Sitka is crazy. Let's look at it, let's reduce it. I realize the process is there, but it looks to me, just from what I have heard so far, is that we get these pieces from all directions, we go through hearings and everything, and then they're put between covers. So far, there's been no indication that anyone has actually asked the kinds of questions that Senator Fakes has, and that adjustments have been made, or justifications have been made. And maybe that doesn't take place, but I think that's basically the question.
It does take place. I don't know which level of review that you wanted me to express. If you are talking about at the system-wide level before it goes to the Board of Regents?
I just want you to tell me, for instance, for Sitka,
mm-hmm.
at what stage did somebody other than in Sitka ask the question, is this excessive
okay.
for Sitka? Are these needs appropriate? Are the materials appropriate? Can we build it for less money? And at what statewide level has this been done?
Well, we review it also at the statewide level. We review it at the regional level with the BRUs. The Cree administration's reviews at that level. When it comes to system-wide level, there is a group other than the facilities planning construction group that reviews it. Now, all kinds of questions I ask before finally it becomes a package.
Okay, but at any of those points, did anyone say, this costs too much, thou shalt reduce it, cut it by 25%, or change the materials to reduce the cost?
Well, there are several committees. The campus committee looks at it and tests it against to see how valid it is, and they go through those iterations. Whether there's, they might reduce some programs to come within a certain figure.
But excuse me, Chris, my assumption is, as with Sumter Joseph's, and the campus committee will want the best and most luxurious and most the ultimate facility. So somebody has to look at it critically and in a way negatively. And say we cannot afford it. Is there anyone who said this costs too much, we cannot afford it?
Well, the Board of Regents is there.
And have they said it for any of the things that are before us? Have they cut any of them down?
Sure, they have. In fact, you know, some of the things that are looked at very critically is how much can the state afford to even substantiate some of those
Any specific building? Have they cut down the Anchorage classroom building? Was that initially $35 million? Did they knock it down to $25 million?
They did. The Anchorage building initially, when the wish list was there, was something like $35 million worth of a building. And they said that was just too much to handle. And they've gone down to several iterations to reduce the program, the type of materials and equipment, and I think it's come to something like 25.3 now.
So that process, that's what I was looking
right.
for. And that's done with the Board of Regents?
With the Board of Regents, at the various committee levels, at the statewide level, whatever those groups are. And there are several groups.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just like to follow through. I think most of us as legislators, and there's a few exceptions that I know of personally, we're all pretty familiar with our own school districts. There's a few of us that are probably pretty familiar with the university campus. My familiarity is just visiting youngsters going up there. But I just like to run you through something within a school district, one of my school districts out there, and then how I relate it to the university. I had an academic, if you will, request come in from one of my school districts, the dream, the ultimate. It was $9.7 million in this community out there. That was an academic, using your terminology, request. As legislators, we went back to them and say, hey, bring this dream out there down to 3.5. You can still educate those kids, you can still accommodate those kids in that area. They came back with 3.8. This was last year. Now, this year coming into the system, they came into the system with 4.4, moving back up towards that academic dream or whoever's planning out all the ultimate out there. We're proposing in the budget today 2.9 to accommodate those kids, and I feel they'll get just as good as education out there with that 2.9, maybe not as plush surroundings as they would have got with that 9.7. And I guess that's kind of where I'm coming from, is to the university. You made this statement of what the state can afford. Maybe a couple of years ago it could afford the 9.8, but those of us who are sitting around the table are wondering if we can even afford the 2.9. And I guess that's the message I'm sending.
Very good question, Senator.
And I don't want to arbitrarily set that 2.9 with something I'm not familiar with, but we may well have to do it.
When we send out phase one instructions like this, we ask very hard questions right at the beginning. There is a wish list. There's always a what we call a laundry list of the dreams that we have. It's always torn down and turned down and turned down till it comes to a point within reason, and that's what's submitted to you.
Chris, let me ask you if I might. What is the method you use to determine payment for your architectural and your design?
In terms of contract, Mr. Chairman?
Isn't it normally still a fee, fixed fee, based on the cost of the project?
No.
10% of the cost, 15%?
We have our own internal fee curves, as we call it, which is based upon like institutions paying that kind of fees around the states from California, Washington, the EIA documents, and our own perceptive of what the industry should pay.
But isn't it true that